This is a download from the BBC. To find out more, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.
A year after President Bush declared mission accomplished in Iraq, the Americans fought their most bloody battle there. More than Baghdad, Basra, Mosul or Tikrit, Fallujah has come to stand for what the coalition did in Iraq, for good or ill. To the US military, Fallujah was where a new greatest generation acquitted itself with honour. Peace campaigners call Fallujah a war crime, the West's Guernica.
The full-scale assault by the Americans on the city of Fallujah is underway. Tanks and armoured vehicles are on the move towards the city, and there are reports of fierce fighting.
What we're looking at now is flashes on the night sky. There's already been one thunderous explosion. That was the engineers laying a 100-metre rope charge to try to detonate the IEDs, the roadside bombs, which are blocking the advance.
In November 2004, I embedded with the US Marines as they fought their way through Fallujah, building by building. The men we followed were careful of innocent life, even at the risk of their own. But the city was left in ruins. It seemed that Fallujah could end up fueling the insurgency in Iraq and terrorism beyond. A lesson in winning the battle, but losing the war. Today, Fallujah is more peaceful than the Marines ever dared hope. But the Americans cannot yet be certain of victory. In Fallujah, in Iraq, or in the wider struggle of which Fallujah became a part.
US forces in Iraq have said they will use overwhelming force to hunt down the killers of four American contractors. The remains of the four men were recovered today. Their bodies had been mutilated and dragged through the streets.
The battle for Fallujah began with a lynching. March 31st, 2004. A jubilant crowd drags the bodies of four American security men through the dusty streets. Limbs were torn off, charred torsos strung up on the bridge at the end of the main shopping boulevard. This event, more than any other, shattered Washington's optimistic assumptions about Iraq. Here was evidence the insurgency was real, and it was growing. Michael Schuer, former head of the CIA's Bin Laden desk, says Fallujah exposed a massive strategic blunder.
Oh, it's an absolutely insane thing to do to invade Iraq. What happened is we fulfilled the predicate for Islamic theology for defensive jihad. An infidel power invading a Muslim country without provocation and installing man-made law instead of divine law. There's almost no way to envision a more stupid foreign policy act than the invasion of Iraq, especially because Saddam was no threat to us. Certainly, Iraq was a monumental disaster. It's one of those things that almost seem like the gods are playing with us before they destroy us.
The acts we have seen were despicable and inexcusable. They violate the tenets of all religions, including Islam, as well as the foundations of civilized society. Their deaths will not go unpunished.
The screams of the Fallujah mob echoed around the world on the rolling news channels. A jolt of anger ran through the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority. "We just wanted to level the place," said one official. The politicians, from the US proconsul Paul Bremer right up to President Bush, agreed that a swift, punitive strike was necessary to maintain American credibility. The military, while equally sickened, were more cautious. Fallujah was overseen by the US Marines, led by General James Mad Dog Mattis. The author, Bing West, was at his headquarters.
General Mattis, who was in charge of the Marines, sent a memo up the chain of command, and he said, "The people who are the ringleaders actually pose for pictures. Give us about 6 to 8 weeks and we can arrest them." And that was the end of it as far as Mattis was concerned. At the other side, Ambassador Bremer and the President, President Bush, got very, very angry, very emotional about this. And the order came down the chain of command, "No, you are to seize the city." And the Marines went up the chain of command and said, in a polite way, they said, do you know what it takes to seize a city of 300,000? Why are we going to seize the city? And the order came back down, you do as you're told. So the Marines said, aye, aye, and they launched the attack against Fallujah, which, of course, and the Marines knew this was going to happen, it united the young men in the town because now they were fighting for their city.
We have to hold out, fight and struggle. This is our land. We did not attack America. It is America that has hacked us. It traveled thousands of kilometers across the oceans to attack us. We have to hold fast to our religion, men, Islam and mosques.
There were, in fact, two battles of Fallujah, the one the Marines were about to fight in April of 2004 and the later, very different battle in November. The common denominator was massive firepower. To trap the insurgents, an order was given that no male older than 14 could leave. Sergeant Adam Kokesh was posted at the notorious bridge where the bodies had hung. After Fallujah, he joined the peace group Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Almost every single family has a male over 14, so you're telling people, you know, stay in the city with your family and risk being blown up by a Specter gunship round, or leave your husband behind, leave your father behind. If you were a male and you were over 14, you looked like you were a fighting age, we turned you back into the city. And looking back on it now, I mean, I think about the anguish that were on those faces, you know, in the situation those people were in, and you know, you just, it's hard to fathom.
American aircraft in Iraq have attacked a mosque in the town of Fallujah, killing up to 40 people. An American army officer, Lieutenant Colonel Brennan Byrne, said his troops ordered the missile strike after coming under fire from Sunni insurgents hiding inside the mosque. The United States military has said five Marines were killed in the exchanges.
Operation Vigilant Resolve began. The rapid strike demanded by the White House meant civilians had no time to flee. Mohammed Abbas was a Red Crescent volunteer in Fallujah.
They seized the city and people in the city, the civilians of the city, and they didn't think that they are going to, you know, Fallujah to be bombed like this. So some people did not leave the city. I saw many civilian families who want to get out of the city, but they could not because it was seized from all sides.
It was far from the surgical arrest mission the Marines had wanted. This was precisely the battle they'd warned the politicians not to fight.
There was a little boy, and he was being carried out of the car, and you could see he'd wet his trousers. He'd been shot through the head, and the women were saying that the Americans had fired on them. They'd gone to leave their house because people had no food, they'd no electricity, because electricity had been cut to the whole town. And that meant that they didn't have water either because the water was pumped electrically. So people were trying to flee the town.
Joe Wilding, a British peace campaigner, risked her life to cross the front lines into Fallujah in April 2004 to help evacuate the wounded.
As we drove through one of the US-held areas, the ambulance was fired on, and it was very clearly marked as an ambulance. It had blue flashing lights, it had a red crescent on the side, it said ambulance on it in English, and they just fired on the ambulance, and we waited, and we thought, they're going to stop, they're going to let us through, they're going to give us some signal that we can go past. And so we just waited for a moment, and then they opened fire on the ambulance. And you could see the bullets going past, the tracer bullets going past, and there was literally nothing we could do but reverse out, and a couple of the wheels got hit. I think probably one of the wheels got hit with a bullet, the other I think burst as we reversed over the central reservation. That for me was a sample of the worst atrocity, if you like, that ambulances were being routinely shot at.
The author Bing West, moving with the Marines, saw things differently.
It became a sniper battle on the rooftops. And the dilemma with Red Crescent, the ambulances, is that in many instances we did see them unloading fighters with rocket-propelled grenades. So you're dealing with an 18-year-old young man up there with his sniper rifle, and he sees them coming forward again. The question is, what are they doing this time? And I think absolutely the insurgents walked far over the line that they should have. And they caused a lot of that, because once everyone's at risk and you don't know anymore, you violated a basic tenet of warfare that's existed for a long time. There's just no doubt in my mind that Al-Qaeda used this in a very cynical way.
Mortars, tanks and artillery were brought to bear on the insurgents. With civilians still in the city in numbers, casualties were inevitable. Sergeant Adam Kokesh says he also saw indiscriminate fire.
Well, what I personally witnessed was disregard for the rules of engagement in terms of positive identification. When you get fired at from a building and, you know, you're getting sporadic fire coming at you, you know, repeatedly, your training is you're going to return fire. But what we have in an occupation of rules of engagement is that you cannot engage a target without positive identification. But what ends up happening in that situation is, in order to stay alive, those Marines will fire back at muzzle flashes and fire back at buildings and windows and things like that. And that I witnessed personally.
Bing West, an ex-Marine as well as a former Assistant Secretary of Defense, said the politicians should have known what would happen.
Anytime you have the law of large numbers and you get into a war, there are going to be individual abuses in any war, including World War II, including the Greatest Generation. So the question is, you recognize that war is a great beast. But once you're in it, you run into these terribly wrenching moral dilemmas. What do you do in order to protect your troops, and how much of a risk do you take when you're getting fire from a house? And you just have to recognize ahead of time that that's going to take place. But I would argue you could take the British and the Americans who fought in Iraq and put them up against the Greatest Generation or any other generation and compare the level of willingness to take casualties on their side versus deliver, and I think they look much better than other generations.
Cale Weston was the CPA's diplomat in Fallujah, attached to the Marines.
As far as, you know, blatant violations of international law, I would not at all put that criticism on our military. But do I think, obviously, there were some civilians and innocent people who were killed? Sure. I dealt with the almost 3 years of the aftermath of that initial push in. The November push and the November battle, I would put in a different category. So the worst aspects of the blood red fog of Fallujah and that war, I think, came from that initial period. And then we were trying to pick up the pieces ever since.
As the April fighting dragged on, Fallujah's plight caused mounting outrage throughout Iraq. Then Ambassador Paul Bremer also ordered the arrest of the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. His Mahdi militia promptly pledged support to the Sunni gunmen in Fallujah. The whole of Iraq seemed about to go up in flames. Panicked, the coalition's civilian leadership called a halt. The Marines were stunned. Just a few more days, they believed, would finish it. The former CIA man, Michael Shuer, says that failing to see the battle through was a serious error.
The decision to call off the first attack by the Marines was a disastrous one, and galvanized the insurgents, whether they were nationalist remnants or foreign fighters. I think the idea that somehow the Marines didn't get it done the first time is a very much a galvanizing impact on that insurgency. There has to be a recreation of the fear, at least, that the Americans will use force unrelentingly, as we traditionally have. I do think that the difference between the culture we face and the culture we are from is such that we don't have enough of an appreciation for how much force and power remain a lingua franca in the Islamic world.
Washington's desire for a demonstration of will in Fallujah had been frustrated by military realities and Iraq's shifting sectarian politics. The retreat also created a new problem. Al-Qaeda now had a safe haven. The Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi and the CPA agreed something had to be done. The task would fall to the Marines' new commander, General Richard Natonski.
Over the course of that summer, more and more insurgents moved into the city. You could not travel into Fallujah. It was truly an enemy insurgent sanctuary. just 40 miles to the west of Baghdad, and the insurgents were using the city of Fallujah. They could go into Baghdad, they could go into Ramadi, throughout the surrounding area, do their attacks, come back, rearm, plan, rest, and then go out and do their attacks again. They were terrorizing the citizens of Fallujah. They were beheading Western hostages in the city. And by the end of September, Prime Minister Alawi and the U.S. military authorities had determined this cancer that was Fallujah could not remain.
Al-Qaeda proclaimed the Islamic Emirate of Iraq, with Fallujah as its capital. They tried to impose strict Sharia law. There were public beheadings in the street. One resident, Ahmed Ali Saif, says the city was paralysed with fear.
In the beginning, Al-Qaeda fought the occupation. Then they turned 180 degrees and started killing innocent people, even our clerics. The name of Al-Qaeda became associated with horror. They destroyed our city. They even stopped our teachers from going to school. People welcomed Al-Qaeda when it was resisting the Americans. But when it targeted Iraqis, everything changed.
But Al-Qaeda had its supporters, who believed, as the CIA's Michael Shua warned would happen, that the organization was fighting a defensive jihad. Here's a local journalist, Burhan Al-Jamali.
Arab fighters could not have entered Fallujah unless some of the people had welcomed them and given them everything they needed. We didn't see Al-Qaeda kill anyone without reason, only for violating Sharia law or for collaborating with the Americans. And it wasn't just Al-Qaeda who carried out beheadings. All armed groups did that.
That summer, the Marines busied themselves with training. The coalition also created a new 2,000-strong Fallujah Brigade of Iraqi troops to bring order to the city. The high hopes for this force quickly came to nothing when they fled, turning over weapons and vehicles to the insurgents. A second battle of Fallujah was unavoidable. But this one would be different. There would be many weeks for the city's residents to leave, and this time, the Marines would not stop until the fight was won. In November 2004, I joined Battalion 1-8 as an embedded reporter. The Marines assembled before the attack. The music was from an old cassette player placed beneath an American flag. This was Operation Phantom Fury, a name later changed to the rather more politically sensitive Operation Al-Fajr, or New Dawn. The Marines gathered that morning looked very young, the men 18 or 19, the officers in their 20s. Many appeared sick with nerves as the Marine Division Sergeant Major, Carlton Kent, gave the eve of battle speech.
Hey, Devin Dallas, how you doing? How you doing, soldiers? How you doing, sailors? Now, this is what I'm talking about. This is a whole can of whoop butt, all combined, okay? And I'm going to tell you one thing. It is an honor for me to be able to serve with each and every one of you hard charges. Y'all in the process of making history. And I am very proud of you. And I have no doubt you're going to go in there and you're going to do what you always have done. Kick some butt, all right?
Yes, sir.
The 1-8 were to seize the main police station and the mayor's office right in the heart of the city. They knew they'd be surrounded on all sides. That was the plan. Put the grunts down in the middle of hostile territory. Kill anyone pointing a weapon at you. It was a dangerous mission, and the 1-8, although just one-tenth of the attacking force, suffered a third of the casualties in the initial assault. In the opening hours of the battle, the 1-8's commander, Colonel Gary Brandle, came striding towards us while everyone else was crouched low. He had wraparound shades, a broad grin, and was biting down on a cigar. It was a performance, one designed to steady his men. Privately, Brandle was in turmoil over the casualties the battalion was already taking. But interviews he gave before and during the battle exude the Marines' moral certainty and relish of combat. The first remark here became one of the most quoted of the Iraq War.
And again, like I said, the enemy has got a face. He's called Satan, and he's in Fallujah. And we're going to destroy him.
Fallujah was known as the City of Mosques. It had more than 100 minarets, and each one seemed to have a sniper. It had been the same in April, and when the Marines returned fire, they'd been criticised in the Arab media for attacking the holy sites. The aim in embedding so many journalists on the second assault was to show why this was necessary.
From those mosques directly ahead.
We're taking fire from the mosque.
We were on the flat roof of Fallujah's main school, the corridors below decorated with children's paintings. The building was 7 or 8 stories high, but 2 minarets close by were taller. Both had snipers. Bullets hissed through the air. Everyone tried to get close to a low wall at the edge of the roof, but it was barely 18 inches high and the snipers had a clear field of fire. The Marines were pinned down. Lieutenant Dan Malcolm ran through the doorway onto the roof. A bullet hit his helmet, bouncing off. He was okay. Skinny and with a large hook nose, he was always easy to pick out. Before the battle, he liked to play chess, the board placed on an upended box of rations. Now his job was to direct mortar fire, and he stayed to do it, even as more bullets skipped across the paving stones. He was the last man off the roof. As he jumped down the stairs, he was hit in the small of the back, just below the flak jacket. He bled to death on the landing. He was 24. Captain Jeffrey Lee was a tank commander attached to the 1-8.
Marines will do whatever they have to do to accomplish the mission. It amazes me. They know, without a shadow of a doubt, that by doing something, they could be killed. They know, before they ever step foot on that attack, that the first guy in probably going to go down. He knows it. But yet, he takes his step and he goes for it anyway.
Captain Lee had himself been shot, clean through the arm. He wrapped a bandage tight around the wound and carried on for 12 hours. I lent him my satellite phone to call his wife. The battle was chaos. For the Marines, a second's hesitation might be the difference between life and death. But time and again, I saw them waiting to make sure the target was a gunman, not a civilian. Casualties were reduced because the city was largely empty. But some accused the Americans of using that to turn Fallujah into a free fire zone, carelessly or even deliberately killing civilians. First Abu Ahmed al-Isawi, then the Fallujah journalist Boran al-Jamali.
The shelling was indiscriminate. Every inch of Fallujah was hit. They used all kinds of weapons. Some bodies were burned, while the clothes were not damaged. That was napalm and white phosphorus. Over loudspeakers, the Americans told people to surrender with white flags. But snipers opened fire, killing men, women, and children. So families stayed in their houses, where they were killed by the heavy shelling. My family and 3 others, 26 people, were arrested after the Americans blew in the front doors of our houses. They stormed in. We were terrified. We were not killed only because of the women and children. The Americans, in some cases, killed men and left only women or children in the houses.
That last allegation of summary executions is not an eyewitness account. We investigated several atrocity stories. Iraqis strapped to tanks as human shields, a mass rape at a girls' school. It was always something people had heard, rather than seen themselves. The Americans did, however, use the incendiary white phosphorus in Fallujah, a fact which, when it emerged, seemed all the more damaging for having previously been denied. But white phosphorus is not necessarily illegal. Carpet bombing civilians with it would have been a breach of the Geneva Conventions, firing it at insurgent trenches and bunkers, the use the Americans acknowledged was not.
New allegations have been made tonight against U.S. Marines fighting their way through Fallujah.
Then a Marine notices one of the five severely wounded men is still breathing. He did not appear to be armed or threatening in any way. In fact, there were no weapons visible in the room beside those carried by the Marines. The Marine then raises his rifle and fires into the man's head. The pictures are too graphic for us to broadcast.
One incident which did unquestionably take place was the shooting of an injured captive. The Marine who did this was later cleared by a military inquiry. That, says General Richard Natonsky, was because the insurgents often attacked after surrendering.
The only people left were the hardcore insurgents from throughout the Middle East. Every cliche you've ever seen in a World War II movie with respect to dirty fighting, from waving a white flag and then throwing it down and shooting at us, to playing dead and getting up and shooting at us, they were on speed, amphetamines. Some of them had wrapped medical hoses around their limbs in case they took a catastrophic loss of a limb so they could continue fighting. They were mean, they were well-equipped, and their sole function was to kill as many Americans as they could.
Well, over on the left.
Much of the fighting in Fallujah was old-fashioned and brutally simple. Marines armed with M16s and grenades were pitted against insurgents with Kalashnikovs and rocket launchers. It was, in that famous phrase, house to house. The insurgents seemed to have expected the Americans to behave like the Russians in Grozny, staying in their armoured vehicles, vulnerable to any militiaman darting out with an RPG. The Marines, though, pursued the insurgents on foot, through the alleyways and into Fallujah's maze of two-storey breeze-block homes. 2 weeks into the November battle, the insurgents were squeezed into the southern tip of Fallujah. They had nowhere else to go. Captain Aaron Cunningham remembers his enemy.
Fanatical comes to mind, not necessarily willing to surrender when it got too tough, but fighting to the death. Obviously, the Marines were tired. At that point, we're going on just pure guts and heart and instinct and training. But yeah, fanatical, I guess, is a good way to sum up the majority of the bad guys that we encountered.
What's your most vivid memory of the place?
As far as vivid memory, the smell of rotting bodies.
Back me up, Matt. Back me up.
A group of insurgents inside a house, just a couple of yards away from the Marines, about to charge in. The insurgents were prepared to die, expected it. And indeed, not long after this was recorded, all in that house were killed. The day before, this same squad's heavy machine gunner had died in action in a similar house. The insurgents grabbed his body and dragged it further inside. The Marines fought for 3 hours to get it back. When it was over, they found 3 insurgents dead, all holding weapons. But one was just a child, maybe 10 years old. The whole squad was deeply upset. In his memoir of Fallujah, called House to House, Sergeant David Bellavere writes about meeting children in battle.
There were many times where I felt within the rules of engagement that I very well should have engaged children. I engaged and destroyed a kid that was probably 14 or 15 years old, and you pretty much have to do your inventory at the end. I lose more sleep over the guys that we buried because I made poor decisions. That's the stuff that keeps me up at night. So it's you can't win. There's nothing pleasant about war. There's nothing pleasant about combat. And urban fighting is the worst of all of it.
If children were killed in Fallujah, it was because fathers had stayed behind to defend their homes. The insurgency was largely Iraqi. ID papers on dead or captured insurgents revealed only 20% were foreign fighters. What was the overall balance sheet of the assault? The Marines thought they'd killed 1,400 insurgents in total, against 95 American dead. The Arab media repeated claims of 6,000 civilian casualties. That figure was dismissed as propaganda by the Iraqi government, which said fewer than 200 families had stayed behind. The city itself had been pulverized. 10,000 buildings were destroyed, including 60 mosques. Two-thirds of what was still standing had been damaged. After all this, the people behind the infamous lynching were still at large. But for the Marines, getting the city back was enough.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. U.S. and Iraqi forces say they're now in control of Fallujah after an offensive that started 12 days ago. That offensive was an effort to prepare for elections in Iraq.
In giving time for the civilians to leave, the Americans had also allowed many insurgents to slip away. This included the feared al-Qaeda leader, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. The Marines gleefully spread the story that he'd fled disguised as a woman. For the Americans, this second battle of Fallujah was where they began to turn the tide against al-Qaeda in Iraq, destroying the myth and breaking the organization's psychological hold. But Michael Shua, who made a careful study of Sunni militancy in his 20 years at the CIA, says Fallujah is now part of al-Qaeda's folklore.
They never expected to win, but they also never expected to delay and throw back an onslaught. So it's a David and Goliath story.
Even though they lost in November?
Absolutely. One of the great things bin Laden has had to deal with as a problem is the defeatism. Arabs and Muslims generally in the Middle East expect to get beat. And turning that around is a very difficult thing, even after the defeat of the Red Army. And so Fallujah, just stopping the Americans and having them withdraw and then have to do it again, that's a victory.
The insurgents' bodies still rotting in the streets, the Iraqi government, with unintended historical irony, declared mission accomplished. But although calm at last returned to Fallujah, the city now surrounded by a ring of concrete and barbed wire, violence increased in the rest of al-Anbar province. Then, from the coalition's point of view, a miracle happened. The Sunnis decided to turn against al-Qaeda. The phenomenon was known as al-Sahwa, the awakening. The Fallujah journalist Burhan al-Jamali points out that many of those who joined it were former insurgents.
They pretend these awakening councils were formed to fight terrorism, but I think, instead, they are a lucrative business. All they want are contracts from the Americans, forgetting that the Americans have invaded and occupied their country. The awakening councils against al-Qaeda were formed by the same tribesmen who had embraced al-Qaeda and who allowed al-Qaeda into Fallujah.
For the American infantryman, people who until only recently had been trying to kill him were now allies. David Bellavia.
The whole politics of what happens after the fight just completely perplexes me. It enrages me. If someone told me that they had shot a rocket or tried to kill or had killed someone that I knew and loved, I wouldn't be able to control my bearing. I'm a human being, and I love those men. I lost 36 of them. We had 320 injured in our year in Iraq. No, there's no way I could compose myself next to someone who took American life.
The armed militias of the Awakening are now tens of thousands strong. It may be happening because Sunnis fear Shiite death squads more than they hate Americans. It may be happening because the sheikhs are now being paid, some would say bribed, to maintain security. If al-Qaeda is beaten, that still leaves the problem of Iraq's sectarian conflict. The Awakening has never been incorporated into the official security forces, which the Sunnis anyway believe are part of a Shiite-run sectarian government. In building up Sunni militias, the Americans could be buying temporary peace from the insurgency, only to hasten all-out civil war. Cale Weston, who was the CPA's diplomat in Fallujah, says there are many ways in which the new peace could be shattered.
I think it's fragile. They are the most difficult, proud people I've ever worked with in my career, and I have a lot of respect for Fallujans because of that nature. Right now, there's an overlap of interests going on, and they're on the payroll, in effect, of the U.S. military. And I, to be honest, just don't know if the temporary solution is going to have a long-term, if it's going to work long-term. I'm not so sure. I don't think our government, and I don't think any government involved in Iraq should assume that it's going to work out quickly or easily. That's never been the case in Fallujah, and it's definitely never been the case in Iraq.
The coalition has always found the conflict in Iraq frustratingly mercurial. First, it was Ba'athist dead-enders and former regime loyalists, then al-Qaeda, then Sunni insurgents, finally Shia militias and the threat of civil war. Most US casualties always came from the Sunni insurgency, so pacifying Fallujah was central to American plans. It is, of course, too early to say if the peace in Fallujah can last, but the Americans believe that what happened there at least gives them the chance of success in Iraq. Bing West has the battle's epitaph.
Fallujah will be remembered as the epic battle of Iraq, just as people can remember, if you will, Iwo Jima. Depending on who you are, you may take away two different lessons from it. From the American side, from the Marine side, they're going to say, we did our job. We won that battle. I know that from al-Qaeda's side, they're going to say, don't ever get into a fight with those guys again. They're nuts. They'll go house to house and hunt you down. If others want to say the Americans used too much force or something, well, that's their choice. They can do that. But we won the battle.
If you've enjoyed this program, you might like to try other Radio 4 podcasts, including Start the Week, lively discussions chaired by Andrew Marr, and a weekly highlight from Radio 4's evening arts program, Front Row. To find out more, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.